Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to bicker about in the interim. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct at 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may be also able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you can just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or unhumanly possible on the station archives. Sometimes on this show, we do the unanticipated. That makes life more interesting, I think. One unanticipated thing happened yesterday. Congressman Ron Paul has taken out papers for an exploratory committee for a run for president. Paul has consistently voted against the neocon cabal, voting against the war in Iraq, the Patriot Act, and every other anti-freedom measure that has come down the pike of late. Speculation is high, and many are hoping to have a real choice in 08. The second surprise is something I decided to share with you today. February 8th is the birthday of James Dean. So today, in anticipation of that event, I'm going to read you one of my Jimmy stories. James Dean was a friend of mine. Our conversations taught me a lot about the world and the things that really matter. The first time I met Jimmy, the lessons began with beanie sandwiches. I was just sitting down to my sandwich when there was a knock at the front door. Mom looked at me and told me to stay put. That was always an issue. I waited until she walked out, and then I wandered out of the kitchen to peer around the corner. Mom was talking to a skinny man who was wearing glasses, just like me. The skinniness struck me first, then the glasses. He introduced himself as a son of somebody or other. I didn't notice the name. Mom invited him in with cluckings and the offer of lunch. He stepped into the entryway and noticed me, sandwich in hand. Beanie sandwiches are cut in long, thin slices, fourths. This strip was drooping badly and leaking onto my hand. I licked it off. It tasted even better that way. Mom grabbed me and returned me to my little table and chair. I twisted around to look at the man as he followed us into the kitchen. He smiled at me and then sat down in the other little chair. He fit snugly. I laughed. I was three then. I had never seen a big person sit at the little table before. So Mom made Jimmy a beanie sandwich of his own. While she was fussing with the sandwich and a glass of milk for him, Jimmy showed me how to peel up the top of my sandwich and scrunch the potato chips into the peanut butter. I liked it. It was different. And it sort of tickled the roof of my mouth when I bit into it. Salt and the taste of the chips against the strawberry jam was interesting, I thought. Jimmy asked my mom for some more things for his sandwich. She told him he could have whatever was in the refrigerator. And Jimmy took her at her word, leaning into its blue interior. Jimmy's sandwich was an unsliced beanie when it started out, but it ended up as something monumental. Into his sandwich, Jimmy put pickles, onions, tomatoes, and ketchup. He cut up the onions and pickles very thin, so he said the flavors could blend right. I'd never seen anyone cut up tomatoes like Jimmy did that day. He made tiny slices so thin you could almost see through them. He used a quarter of a tomato, a respectable piece of onion, and a whole pickle. because he ate the part he didn't slice up for the sandwich, first dipping it in his milk and the ketchup. It was wonderfully icky. I made a face, and he made the same face back at me and rolled his eyes and said, mmm, yummy. So then I wanted a bite of his. It was interesting. The flavors hit my tongue and nose, sweet, tangy, and tart together, making the sensations new and unfamiliar. I was not sure I liked it at first, but I liked the way Mother looked when I took the bite, so I kept chewing and then swallowed. Jimmy laughed. I took another bite. Then Jimmy retrieved his sandwich, and I finished off my beanie with the potato chips. Afterwards, Jimmy insisted on helping with the dishes, and Mom let him dry, directing him to where the dishes were kept. He did everything just the way she wanted, something that was hard to do, a trick that neither of my sisters, Carol or Anne, had gotten down. When Anne was 40, she still could not satisfy Mother when she dried the dishes. The kitchen was always immaculate. Mother sterilized the counters and sink with bleach at least once a week, letting the bleach sit. She wiped it with bleach every day. After I finished my sandwich and the Fritos, I watched and listened to Mother and Jimmy talk from the yellow stepping stool that lived in the kitchen for most of the time I was growing up. This time I sat on the top step, but often I like to pull out the steps and sit there and stick my legs through. The step chair was new then. It had come to live with us the previous Christmas. It would become the staging area for my slinky when that arrived. Mom asked Jimmy about his family in Fairmount and about his father. Jimmy told her about the farm where he had grown up with his aunt and uncle, and about doing chores in the house and around the farm. He told her about school, his teachers, playing basketball, and eventually he told her about the funeral for his mother. His voice changed then. It got deeper and held something that made me sad. I held my breath while I listened to him talk. I knew by now Jimmy spoke that his mother was still with him, still important to his life and who he wanted to become. Later, when we were talking about the fairies, he told me more about her. When the dishes were finished and Jimmy had laid out the dish towel on the dish rack, just like Mom told him to do, she asked Jimmy if he'd like to see the rose bushes in the backyard. Jimmy's mom had liked roses, and my mom loved roses, too. Although the reports of the trials and tribulations of the rose bushes were given like news updates from a war. So with that, Jimmy held the door for my mom and smiled at me when I came too. The avocado tree dominated the backyard on Colby Avenue. Eventually, it would grow into a great-grandmother of a tree bearing avocados all year long. Then it was still young, but already good for climbing. The tree had begun its life as an experiment at the agricultural division at UCLA. It was the first of its kind, my father said when he brought it home to be planted with great ceremony in the back corner of the yard, far enough in so it could stretch its limbs, and close enough to the fence so it would be out of the way of the lawn. Father said it had graduated from the university to do its job for us, making shade, producing avocados, and being climbed. Father had worked with the agricultural department before academia reshuffled things, and he was magically reestablished in engineering and then water resources, which meant he had to be resourceful about watering, he used to say. Father's degree was from Stanford in civil engineering. Mom was showing her roses to Jimmy, pointing out the colors and other details, like aphids. The War of the Aphids was a theme that brought on updates at various times to all of us. I wandered off. I was not much interested in roses. I had been pushed into a small grove of them some months earlier and had not forgotten the experience of being a pincushion. I went off to play under the avocado tree while they talked. That was my favorite destination in the backyard for making mud pies. The tree murmured, making comforting, familiar sounds as its leaves danced and wavered in the wind. Being under the tree made me feel like there was a tent overhead, and under the tree it was always cool. For some reason, the mud there was especially fine-grained and therefore looked like chocolate. It didn't taste like chocolate, though. I'd already ascertained that on a previous occasion. As I made up hamburger patties of mud, folding these into other shapes, suddenly an idea struck me. I had something I wanted to show Jimmy. I knew he would like to see it. He would appreciate it as no one else would. They were just walking back into the house when I grabbed Jimmy's hand. I told him he had to come and look at something right now. My mother smiled and went in the house. Stevie had started to cry. I could hear him. A tingle of excitement runs through me even now when I remember dragging Jimmy by the hand over the concrete pathway along the side of the garage. My arm is up at an angle because he was so much taller than me. I looked ahead to the rather dense and tall bush against the back fence. On one brief occasion, I was off the ground because I was pulling so hard. Jimmy was going to be impressed. I just knew it. I rounded the tall bush and pointed triumphantly. The bush leaned slightly outward, creating a small alcove behind it. There was just a foot or so of space, and there was my prize. I had been visiting it for weeks. I didn't know how it got there. It certainly had not been ours. The dead tortoise had been past all hope when I first found it there, spread-eagled on its back. I'd been watching it be eaten by ants for these many weeks, never mentioning it to anyone. I tried to look every few days, although I knew that I should not tell Mom. She would remove it, I was pretty sure. Jimmy looked at the tortoise for a long time, just standing there. And he squatted down to get a better look, pushing the bush aside. He looked at me and smiled, his eyes crinkled up at the corners, as I stood there waiting for his reaction. I have lived a long life, but I have never again been so right about someone who was still nearly a stranger. Jimmy was delighted. He nodded. We understood each other. Then Jimmy told me that he had been watching the same process himself back in Fairmount, only it was with a whole cow. I shuddered. Cows were huge, and without shells, you could see much more. Jimmy was the first person with whom I discussed the physical process of mortality. Normally, when things like goldfish died, they were immediately buried, usually in the toilet, after a brief prayer. That did not allow me to check back and see how things were going. I had yet to persuade my parents to let me bury a deceased goldfish in a Band-Aid box to be dug up later for minute examination. The tortoise came first. Jimmy filled me in on various aspects of the process with horrid expressions of face and gestures of hands as he made rubbery faces that made me laugh. We had a cat then, Tiger Lady, Lady Tiger, when his gender was correctly identified. Tiger was still a fluffy, kittenish presence then. Mortality was an issue still past my horizon for anything but goldfish and the tortoise. I was curious about the physical process of death, but Jimmy did not leave it there. With Jimmy, answers led inevitably to more questions. Jimmy told me right then and there that the essence of the tortoise was gone. Its form remained, but the thing that had built it out of the raw materials of the earth, just like we were built, had left its body and moved on. With just a few words, Jimmy had given me more things to think about. From the process of the deterioration of the physical body, we had arrived at the question of the force that creates and moves the body while it lives, and the destination of that essence after death. Those questions were revelations in themselves. How were we built out of the earth, I wondered, looking down at the dirt. I put that thought away for another time. Now I wanted to know where the tortoise had gone, if any place. I asked Jimmy. He paused, cocked his head to one side, and looked right at me. He told me he didn't know exactly. He wondered himself if it was a place we could really understand while we were still in our bodies. Perhaps we'd have to wait to know. He told me that if he found out, he'd tell me. He nodded as he said this. Jimmy did not mind admitting the limits of his knowledge. The death and aftermath of the life of tortoise opened up a series of conversations about the nature of the world to me that filled several of Jimmy's visits and spilled over into conversations with my father, too. Death, Jimmy told me, was not the end of life for the tortoise any more than it was the end of our own lives when death came. The essence that made us what we are continued. When he told me this, he pointed out that I could not see the wind, only the things the wind carries. I was only aware of the light when it was gone. But all of these things were far more tangible than the essence that created and moved the tortoise. All continued. Death was transition and illusion. I already accepted that Jimmy would not lie to me. That was part of the trust that came with his reaction to the tortoise. but I had learned that people would tell me things that were not strictly factual and often thought this was funny. Jimmy didn't do that. Jimmy told me the truth as he saw it, about everything that came up. When he told me to think it out for myself and never, never accept what others say is the truth until I had done that. That was the first lesson that Jimmy taught me. Death is not the end. The essence continues. Question what you think is true. Trust yourself. And now our thought for the week ahead. Part of being really free is keeping the management of things in the hands of the people. What we think of as government is really just a bundle of services we've assigned to an organization that we call government. That means that these services should be local, and the community should make the decisions and take responsibility for paying the bills. Unfortunately, that's not how it works today. With unfunded mandates coming down on Americans like a snowstorm, towns, cities, and states are finding it impossible to comply. This costs all of us and puts Americans in debt to government. Instead of us controlling government, government controls us. That's wrong, and something needs to be done about it. A few people are doing just that. Our guest today is working on returning control of local government to the people. Mr. Owens has been involved in politics since the 60s, but found his true calling in helping his town survive the bane of government. Elected as chairman of the Board of Supervisors of London Britain Township in Landenburg, Pennsylvania, the determined Owens has led the Board of Supervisors in the town with a population of only about 4,000, but innovated continuously, creating exciting examples of how libertarianism works in real life. Quote, for those who don't speak the language of Pennsylvania, townships essentially means I'm mayor of a small town of about 4,000 people, Owens said. Through such seemingly boring edicts as unfunded mandates for water quality, government bureaucracy is destroying the financial well-being of towns and cities across the country. They don't do that in London, Britain, at least not as long as Owens has anything to say in the matter. Please welcome David Owens. David, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm just fine. Winter time here in Pennsylvania.
And for a lot of the rest of the world up in this northern part of the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for being with us today. And, you know, we always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves.
Okay.
So why don't you tell us something about David Owens?
Well, I am 48 years old. I was originally from Tennessee. Grew up as basically a NASA brat, moving around a lot with the space race. My father was involved in it. My mother was a French cooking teacher. I'm an only child. Became interested in politics at a very young age. We were living in Washington, D.C. at the time of the Kennedy administration and the Kennedy assassination. And we would always take lots of trips to, we would do everything that Washington had to offer as a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I became interested in politics and started working in campaigns at a very young age. Eventually settled in Pennsylvania, was transferred up here for a job that I was working. Liked it so much that my wife and I, when I got married, we eventually, after a brief stint out in Arizona and Florida again, we settled here and bought a nice home, and I decided to get involved in local politics.
Aha! Uh-huh.
I've been running other people's campaigns for years. I've been involved with the Libertarian Party, running campaigns since, 88. And You know, when we did settle down, it was time for me, instead of managing other people's campaigns, to run myself. And I did, and won by a whopping 11 votes.
That's not that bad.
It was a real squeaker. And so I've been in now, in office, going on 2 years now.
And it sounds like your constituency likes what you do.
Yeah, well, I've been getting a lot of good feedback about that. It's really just applied libertarianism, and you don't hear a lot about that. You hear a lot about libertarian philosophy and thought, but this is really applied libertarianism.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, one of the things about political philosophies, of course, is that nobody expects them to take them so seriously that they actually use them. But in your case, that's exactly what you're doing. You're taking the philosophy and applying it to the nitty-gritty stuff of how people get along in their local areas,
mm-hmm.
and how they deal with that curious creature called government.
Yes.
And when you first became active and you saw that there was this town and there were all of these things happening, there were problems that faced you. There were problems that the town had, some of them related to your water, some of them related to the local wildlife, and there were riparian questions, right?
Yeah. You want to talk about some libertarian things that I've done?
Let's do it this way. Tell us the problem and how it confronted you and how you applied the libertarian idea to making it better.
Why don't we start with our deer feeder program. That was one of the first things that I worked on. Are you familiar with Lyme disease?
Yes, but why don't you tell our listeners something about it?
Okay, it is a terribly disabilitating disease that is transmitted by the Lyme ticks or deer ticks, and they are tiny. They're about the size of a pinhead, and they bite deer, contract a bacteria, and then they'll bite a human and transmit.
To the doctor.
Right. it would be nice if we could run all the deer through like a sheet dip, but you can't do that.
It's hard to catch them, so you can do that.
So we deployed, we used the Lyme disease support group money to buy 30 deer feeders and a corn silo, and we advertised it and got 30 different families around our township to volunteer to be host for deer feeders. And we've had marvelous success. We've got about a 25% reduction in the incidence of Lyme disease in our township, and we're very pleased with it. And it is a case of, it was done with private grant money. It's done with volunteer families hosting the program, and it's been going on now for it's going on for two and a half years now.
Well, and that's a real success.
Yeah, it is.
Because here's something that was a problem, and you were confronted with it, and you found a way for a small area to make use of the resources that were available to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. It is a case of a health problem being addressed, of a small government addressing a health problem using volunteerism and private money, and like I said, our numbers are down,
mm-hmm.
25%.
But let's look at something for a minute here, because you said a government.
Yeah, it
but the government's not acting like a government. It's acting more like just a voluntary association.
Yes, it is.
I just point that out because, we have an assumption with government that it has to use force, and obviously that's not the case. You can use cooperation.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And our deer feeder program is something that has been a volunteer run with, like I said, private donations and volunteers. And I find something interesting. I have this deep belief in the American people that if your cause is just and you bring the problem and the solution to the American people, that they'll react. And our township has. We even have a waiting list of more people who would host deer feeders. Whenever somebody drops out of the program, we almost immediately have somebody else in line that wants to participate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes people move. We continue to receive donations from various groups that see what we're doing and say, hey, that's something that's good and it's working, and it's not a big bureaucracy, and our numbers are down.
Mm-hmm. So it's a win-win-win. Even the deer win.
Yes. Yeah, the deer probably suffer terribly from all these ticks.
You could even sell T-shirts, you know.
Well, we do have T-shirts in Landenburg. They say, Landenburg, you can't get there from here. It's real typical for a libertarian town to say. Landenburg, let me first describe to you where I'm coming from. It is in the very corner. We make up the corner of Maryland, Delaware, and Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
We are where the Mason-Dixon line starts. Okay, we have a little stone in our town where all those three states come together and the Mason-Dixon line takes off and forms the southern border of Pennsylvania and the northern border of Maryland.
And it's a very rural area, of course.
Yeah,
you have
it's
the deer.
A very rural area, and if you were to picture in your mind, you would picture like an Amish setting, although the Amish live further west in Lancaster County.
Mm-hmm.
So the deer feeder program was has been and is continuing to be a very libertarian philosophy turned reality health program,
mm-hmm.
in which government partners with the private people.
And, of course, the most interesting part of this is that through innovation, you can find a way to solve a problem and take the control back to the government in the local area.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also means that as a libertarian, you have to get off your butt and go do something. It takes leadership. All these things we were going to talk about tonight, the deer feeder program, our riparian buffer on our streams, and building a fire station, all require leadership, just plain old simple leadership.
All right, somebody pointing and saying, that way, we're going to do this.
Yes.
And this is why it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't have a problem cooperating when that's the case.
No, people, that's what I'm saying. The American people are a just people. And if you're not shoving something down their throat and you make your case, like, you know, we have all these people catching Lyme disease. This, do this, let's treat the deer, and do it on a volunteer basis. And they come out of the woodwork to volunteer to help out.
Mm-hmm.
And 25% less people in our little district have contracted Lyme disease in the past 2 years.
Well, that's a huge change, and certainly that's very worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said you always also had a problem with not having a fire department.
Yeah, London Britain Township does not have a fire department, and we have, we have bad response times. It'll take 21 minutes for the fire company from the next town over to get here. And 21 minutes when your house is on fire is an awfully long time.
Yes.
The fire company, one of the local fire companies, they are private corporations. And what we did was we have a town park, and through another triumph in grant writing, both there were some public grants in that. We bought a 19-acre expansion to our park.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been in the works for years before I came along. But we set aside 2.5 acres in that expansion of our park for ground for a new fire station. And rather than grow the government and create our own fire station, we've made a arrangements with the other private corporation that is a fire company, and we are going to be building our own substation.
Mm-hmm. So now you were taking care of the problem, and what will the response time be for the township?
2 and 3 minutes.
Well, that's a huge improvement.
Yes. And and if you live in London Britain Township or Landenburg, your property insurance rates will go down. And that's one thing that I always wanted to do ever since I was a kid. I always wanted to make it cheaper for people to live through something that I did in government. Somehow, you know, I'd always wanted to cut taxes or do something like this. Through privatization, build the fire station, and now your insurance, your property insurance rates will go down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very excited about doing that. We hope to break ground this spring, late spring, early summer, on starting to build our substation.
Mm-hmm. So you took care of a problem that, because you would have had to go get the capital to build it in the first place.
Right.
Which would have meant probably going into debt, right?
Yeah, we would have. The fire company already has $250,000 set aside to build the building, but land is so expensive that we're going to lease them on a long-term lease the land, and they're going to get a real sweetheart deal on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll build the building. They've even got a few fire trucks already. And it'll just be another, it'll be volunteer fire department. I mean, they have, like, paid employees, but there will be volunteers there as well.
That's good. Of course, a lot of American fire departments actually are manned by volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. It tends to bring the community together in a common cause, mm-hmm. which can actually create a lot of other good things as well. Have you noticed, as you have gone through these cooperative efforts in the town, that you've gotten more cooperation and more sense of community?
Yeah, you always do when you don't try to shove government down people's throats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you present your case, and if your case is just, I find that volunteers just start coming out of the woodwork, and things get done.
So now you don't have a problem getting people to volunteer to do things that need to be done. And, of course, in time that's put in by volunteers means that's time you don't have to pay for and you don't have to create a public employee, which
Absolutely.
Can come with a lot of other costs.
Absolutely. There will be no additional public employees with the fire station. We're not going to go into the business of putting out fires.
Okay, you also had a problem with you have a stream. And
yeah.
Tell us what the condition of the stream was.
The stream has always been, well, the stream is called the White Clay Creek. And what's going on there is the Clean Water Act of 1972. Has created all kinds of giant bureaucracies in the environmental side of government. I sometimes call it environmental tyranny. Our White Clay Creek is, you can't drink out of it, but you can catch the fish in it and eat the fish. There is a family of otters has moved into it. They live in it. It was given a grade last month by the White Clay Creek Preservation Group in conjunction with the University of Delaware, graded it, and we received a B rating. They created a scale A, B, C, D, E, F.
Mm-hmm.
So that everybody could understand.
So it had been a stream that had some problems before.
It had some problems years ago. And right in our section of it, it is relatively clean. Okay? Like
mm-hmm.
I said, you can't drink out of it. But for creeks in America, in this section of the country, it's a very clean creek.
Okay, and
now the problem has been with stormwater runoff. Now, our little town we have the benefit that DuPont was a big employer in Delaware. So our town was full of DuPont engineers that would go to work in Delaware and come home here, and then they would get involved in their township. So
mm-hmm.
past supervisors for 30 years have been DuPont engineers. And they quickly recognized that one of the things that can get you here is flooding, and that you have to manage your stormwater runoff or else it all runs into the creeks and the creeks rise and the whole town gets flooded out. So for years, we adopted performance-based ordinances, which says that basically, yes, it's your property, you can build whatever kind of house that you want to do with, but you cannot commit a trespass with your runoff water.
Aha!
Okay, which is a very libertarian thing. Yes, it's your property, but thou shalt not trespass. So our ordinances have taking the water that hits your roof and runs in your gutters, and we send it down like French drains.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, we don't have a lot of flooding.
Well, you have much less erosion, too.
Right. So other townships weren't so fortunate. And so when a stormwater management ordinances are not ordinances, they're dictates from the federal government.
These were actually unfunded mandates, weren't they?
Oh, they are completely unfunded. You know, they require you to do a bunch of things, and because our town is engineered properly, we don't have these problems. They assume that our creek is, you know, a running cesspool, when the, you know, you could go down there, and if you were lucky, you could fish for dinner in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are now requiring that we do all kinds of testing and do it monthly. And they're giving us absolutely no money to do that.
And so what they're doing is requiring you to do something that you don't need, but they've decided that everybody should do just for the heck of it,
mm-hmm.
without taking a look at how much it's going to cost the local areas. To do that, and these things can actually impact you to the point where a township could conceivably not be able to pay for, say, essential services because it has to keep, it has to be compliant, right?
Absolutely. Every penny that we spend on doing things that we've already done is a penny I can't spend on fixing a pothole.
Mm-hmm.
And the people expect me to keep the roads in good shape and keep the snow off of them and, you know, the basic services that we've all agreed to be governed by.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a real constitutionalist that way. I believe that, you know, people get together, we do a constitution at the national level, and we agree that that's what government will do. We do it at the state level. There are county charters and township charters, and those are the things that we put down in black and white, we vote on, and that's what the government is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And these regulations come along, and they're unnecessary in our case, and they cost us lots of money. So I spend a great deal of time reading these unfunded mandates and figuring out how to get around them.
Yes. And you've done many things that you weren't required to do. You actually built in a buffer zone,
mm-hmm.
by planting trees. That's helped increase the quality of the area around the stream, right?
Yeah, that's called the riparian buffer. There is a whole series of good research that basically tells you that if you had 50 to 100 feet of trees along your waterways, that the trees naturally clean up the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And we have repaired our riparian buffer, and we are continuing to repair our riparian buffer. This spring, I'll be leading an effort where we're going to get some private grant money. We have arborists who live in our township that volunteer their services. We have Boy Scout troops for the labor to plant trees. And we're going to take our case to the people again. We're using aerial photography to determine where we don't have 50 to 100 feet of trees along the White Clay Creek. And then we're going to go to the individual property owners and explain to them about how to keep the creek healthy and ask them if they would like to host some of these trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get arborists that can work with the landowners for the placement of the trees. And we can get Boy Scouts who are doing Eagle Scout projects to come out and actually do the labor of planting the trees.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a way to do it that involves people on a long-term basis again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way that you could almost see America would have continued if we hadn't had the interference of government.
Absolutely. And so that's what we're doing. We're keeping our riparian buffer up. Our creek is getting good grades, and know, people love their trees. That's another thing that I'm kind of sick and tired of, is that this assumption by government that we're all evil and wicked, and that we need government to keep us from being evil and wicked. My first position in government, or on a committee in a township, was I was on the tree board in Micanopy, Florida, when we were living in Florida doing my wife's residency. Micanopy is a little town south of Gainesville.
Mm-hmm.
And she was there at Gainesville doing her residency, and so I got involved on the tree board. And two things were very interesting about that. Was I got on the tree board as a property rights libertarian. If you bought a piece of property, those trees were yours. And the township had come up with a bunch of ordinances saying that you had to jump through all these hoops every time you wanted to cut down one of your own trees. So I was basically got on that board to try to uphold people's rights to do with their property as they would see fit. What I found were two things: that people absolutely loved their trees and would only cut them down when they either got damaged by lightning or a storm or something like that, and they absolutely had to. And then a second interesting thing happened. Micanopy got attacked by pine beetles that got into the pine trees and just absolutely, when a pine beetle gets in, they bore into the tree and they kill it.
Mm-hmm.
So the pine beetles would come along and kill the trees, and I would have to go out and meet with the people when they wanted to cut down the dead trees, and people were just in tears. And because they loved their trees. And so it was a case, the case became the town was getting attacked by an insect, and as a libertarian, I will always defend the town. But it was a case of having to defend the town against an insect.
Well, actually, it sounds like one of the things you're saying the government does is it creates almost it wants to take, you know, a parental role with people and all of their property.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're really saying is that it isn't really the people in the minds of the government that own the property at all. I mean, they're just allowed to use it, you know, under the control of the government.
Yes, and that's where I part company with that. With the government, I believe, just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
That it's your property to do with as you see fit, so long as you do not commit a trespass.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's a very, very different way of looking at the world.
Unfortunately.
Yes. And as you've done this and gotten to know people and brought them together as a community to work on problems, you've seen a rise in activism.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen people's attitudes change. Do you notice what their attitude is when they feel like it is actually them making the decision and them being in control?
Yeah,
is there a difference?
Get done. Attitudes become actions. Trees get planted. Diseases get, you know, defeated. Fire stations get built.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, things actually happen. Progress takes place.
Do people feel better about themselves, too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People become proud of their communities.
And that has a lot of different impacts when they feel proud of their community. Does it sort of build their cooperative muscles, too, so that there's more and more they can do?
Yes. You know, good begets good. I'm convinced of that.
But at the same time, you've continued to have problems with a government that wants to continue to have control.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that in Chester County that we are really seeing what's making government grow is all this Homeland Security stuff. They are taking our township employees, the county is. Our county government has grown to, I think it's $433 million a year. I remember when it hit $1 million a day a couple of years ago. But a lot of the growth in our county government has been all this 911 stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we print T-shirts from Landenburg saying you can't get there from here. I seriously doubt if Osama bin Laden and his gang of terrorists are... We don't even have a building here for them to fly a plane into, you know what I mean?
It had to have to be into the Otters, right?
Yeah. They could fly a plane into the woods or something and cause us all kinds of problems. And Landenburg was marched through by the British Army on their way to the Battle of Brandywine.
Who do you think does more damage? The British marching through or the government marching through?
The government, by far.
So that could be a T-shirt, don't you think?
Yeah. We have had a foreign army in Landenburg in the past. So, you know, but this emergency preparedness stuff, it has made us better for the things that can get us. Tornadoes, we've had a tornado here that went through the town back in the 90s. Flooding, as I said, but we don't flood. I went to the Libertarian Convention in Portland last year, and Chester County had received a bunch of rain, and it was on the national news, all the flooding in Chester County. And we didn't have any flooding in Landenburg because we take care of our stormwater runoff. And when I got to Portland, people were coming up to me saying, "Hey, man, I saw Chester County on the news. I didn't think you'd be here. You know, I thought you'd have to be back home." I said, "No." You know, I made jokes about it. We'd taken care of that problem. But the things that I was saying that can get you, a tornado can get you, a flood can get you, and a blizzard, you know, can get you.
It sounds like what you're saying is that you're being proactive, you're making sure that the community is taken care of, which is exactly what you want to have people do. Because right. If you make sure yourselves that things are handled in advance, things like New Orleans don't happen.
Yeah, New Orleans is with their if you know New Orleans, that the town sits on a sliver of land in between the lake and the river, they're much more vulnerable to something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is that they're using this 911 stuff to just absolutely increase the size and scope of government. They're making our road crew and our codes enforcement officer do all this extra work, and they're not paying a cent for it.
Well, and you're going to change that, I bet.
That's a lot bigger than me.
Well, we'll see. I think that you're just exactly the right guy to do that, and I can see that you've made a great start. And I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And I know you're going to continue, and I'm going to look for updates on exactly what is going on where you're in charge.
Okay.
You take care, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Great.
Thanks. You have a good weekend.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night.
And that's our show for today, Friday, January 12th, 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to bring government into alignment with the way we know we should be treating others, personally, in business, and in every other point in our lives. Freedom and doing the right thing matters in all parts of our lives. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.